Hello, and welcome to The Rover, the podcast for the Astrobiological Research and Education Society. I'm Charlotte Applin, and today I'm joined by David Merced to talk about exoplanets. So what is an exoplanet, David?
An exoplanet is, well, they're not like other girls, you know?
No?
They're not. They're a planet. But they are also not like other planets.
How are they not like other planets, David? What sets them apart?
Because exoplanets, or extrasolar planets, are planets that are not in our solar system. So maybe they are like other planets, and our planets are the ones that are unique.
How do we know exoplanets exist if they're so far away? Like, how long have we known about them?
Well, they were theorized to exist, you know, in times as early as 1917, because obviously if there were other stars out there, then what if there are other planets, you know? But first exoplanet was, like, confirmed to exist in 1992, which is really recent.
Yeah, it is. Currently, 4,104 exoplanets have been confirmed to exist, and there's actually a counter you can look at exoplanets.nasa.gov. So how do we know all these planets are there? Well, there are a few different methods.
Yeah, the first and the most classic method is the transit method. You know, the planet passes in front of the star's light gets blocked because obviously there's something in front of it. And, you know, that's like planet finding 101, you know? They just look at the stars, and every time a star would, like, blink, they'd be like, it could be a planet.
It's dimmer now. It wasn't like that before.
Oh, yeah, because they wouldn't even fully, like, go dark. They just dim a little bit because the planet can't block all the light. Well, depending on size and relative distance. But usually they don't because they're not extremely huge.
Yeah, Mercury recently did a transit in front of the sun, and it was very, very tiny.
But there is another method called Doppler spectroscopy, or if you want to get technical, the wobble method.
Wobble baby, wobble baby, wobble baby, wobble. No. So what happens with the wobble method, David? I assume there's some kind of wobbling involved.
Well, as a planet orbits its star, it's not just the planet moving around the star, but they actually have a sort of very, very small binary system in which they both orbit around a shared focus or a barycenter. And because the planet is so small compared to its star, the barycenter is usually somewhere inside the star, so really, it doesn't matter. But Technically, there still is that movement of the star itself because of the planet. So it'll go back and forth a little bit as the planet orbits around it.
We can see that a little bit from Earth using some strong telescopes.
And spectroscopy.
Spectroscopy. Is that part of Doppler spectroscopy?
Oh yeah, that's where the wobble comes in, baby. So as the star moves closer to us, its light will become shorter or blue shifted. And as it moves away, the wavelength of its light will get a little longer and it'll be redder or redshift. Now, there's no way you can see this with, like, the naked eye. It's, like, impossible. But with some very powerful telescopes, like, you can tell.
So why don't we talk a little bit about the telescopes that are looking around for exoplanets using the transit and method and the wobble method?
So some of the telescopes that are out there wobbling and looking for some blinking stars, you got Kepler, which is, you know, a classic. It was launched in 2009, and somewhere along the way got a little hurt, but, you know, it's okay now. They're doing good. Maybe not, you know, as 100% as they were in the past, but they're still out there working hard.
Looking at stuff in space.
And also there's Hubble, another classic that we just cannot forget.
The Hubble Space Telescope is just iconic at this point. Everybody knows the Hubble Space Telescope.
It's given us so much information on other planets, and because of it, we've even been able to tell a little bit about the atmospheres of some of these exoplanets, because also with, like, light, we can tell what elements are in that light spectrum that are coming to us. Mm-hmm. And that tells us, you know, a little bit about what makes up the planet.
That's interesting. So that's how we can kind of find out which planets may or may not be like Earth, or more like the further out planets such as Jupiter or Saturn.
Oh, yeah. And it really helps us to classify the different types of planets out there in terms of not just how far they're calculated to be from their star, which is a whole nother thing, but also, oh, these types of planets typically form around this area, like this distance from their star. And that can be really good in helping us not just understand other solar systems, but the formation of our own.
So what are some more telescopes that are looking around?
There was a telescope that preceded Kepler, the European COROT, or it's C-O-R-O-T. But there are also others, you know, NASA's Spitzer SPT is looking around for these planets. TESS, which stands for the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite, was launched pretty recently in April 2018 atop a Falcon 9 rocket from SpaceX.
That's pretty cool. It's interesting to see how SpaceX's rockets are actually benefiting, like, space exploration. So in the future, we hope that the James Webb Space Telescope will be looking for more exoplanets, and we'll look at some that TESS has already looked at and try and learn more about them, because it's supposed to be wicked strong.
Oh yeah, we've been hearing about the James Webb Space Telescope for a while now, and we are just so excited about it. I'm looking forward to when it finally gets launched and we can start looking at these planets, because they think they can hide from us, but they can't. Because we will find them. We will.
We will find you, and we will identify you. So, speaking of identification, what are the different types of exoplanets out there? Well, there are a few.
Yeah, first you have your classic rocky terrestrial planets, and these are...
David, are we on a rocky terrestrial planet?
Yes, we are. Believe it or not, our blessed Earth is a terrestrial planet.
It's got... Wait a second, it's got that Terra in it. I wonder if there was some sort of connection that people have paid attention to. No, no one would do that. People don't care about the names of planets.
You know, I think it's obvious that Terra and Earth have something in common. It's just common knowledge, you know? That's knowledge that everyone knows. It's common knowledge, Charlotte.
Everyone knows this. It's common knowledge.
It's common knowledge. You know it. I know it.
We both know it. Moving on.
So these terrestrial planets can be made from like things, like a wide range of things, from metals to silicates to even like carbon. And they generally have like a solid surface with, they can have liquids, you know, like they can.
Got some water on.
Yeah, they get a little water. They're thirsty.
Some sort of fluids.
But they usually have some sort of molten core. Although in some certain planets, you know, this core could have, you know, solidified a long time ago and become just a hard ball of, like, metals and irons. Although there are some wacky ones out there, such as ice planets. But these ice planets aren't your typical ice. No, they're made of ice 7.
What is ice 7, David? So, I didn't even know about ices 1 through 6.
Oh, I didn't either. But ice 7 is crazy. And I think it's kind of like ice 6, but that doesn't matter. We're talking about ice 7, not ice 6, ice 7.
Ice 7 would be extremely offended to know it was compared to ice 6.
And I cannot wait until the iPhone 8 comes out.
I am going to go absolutely nuts. I waited in line for ice 7, so.
Yeah, but anyways, ice 7 is when water is under such immense pressure that it's forced into a solid state. And this happens when the molecules are under, like, such extreme pressure that they are forced to line up in a sort of solid configuration. Like, they're not allowed, like, they aren't able to move around as freely as they would in a liquid state. And so even if the temperature was well beyond the boiling point of normal water, it's still ice.
That's crazy.
I mean, technically, their boiling point would now be at a very high temperature. It's just now ice can exist at temperatures like several thousand degrees Fahrenheit.
So now that we know about ice 7, what else have you got for us? What are the solids?
Well, how do you feel about diamonds?
I have to say, I'm kind of a fan of diamonds.
Because there are, this is another theoretical type of planet. The I-7 is technically another theoretical, but it's very likely that it exists due to, you know.
There's theoretical that probably exists, and then there's theoretical where it's like, man, that'd be cool.
Because water can be fairly common, and, you know.
Yeah.
In planets that have immense pressure. I mean, even our gas giants might have some I-7 in them. Who knows? But carbon planets are a little bit funkier, because these planets are believed to have metal cores that are surrounded by a bunch of carbon-based materials, which could also, because of immense pressure, end up forming pure diamonds. So yeah, if you know, potentially extreme amounts of diamond in some carbon planet doesn't excite you. I don't know what does. But then again, the diamond industry is a monopoly, so whatever.
Whatever.
But then there are something called super Earths.
Super Earths? That sounds awesome.
Yeah, these things are planets that are just like Earth, but they had a terrible accident. They either got bit by a radioactive spider or they fell into some vat of like radioactive liquid and who knows? I mean, maybe this is what pollution will lead to, a super Earth.
So what is a super Earth actually, David? We could like totally live on them, right?
When I said that they were like Earth, well, they can be nothing like Earth because they're usually between 1 and 10 Earth masses. So,
oh, 10 Earth masses? That's yeah. Just like Earth.
Yeah.
Except 10 times bigger.
And just because they're called a super Earth does not mean that they're habitable. We are just really dumb with our names sometimes, and we like to name things in the most misleading way possible. And even again, they're not necessarily rocky. They can just be water worlds or kind of gaseous. So what I'm trying to say is that the super Earth category is based purely on mass and nothing else.
How could you lie to me like this, David?
Because I wanted to be cool, you know? I wanted to look cool in front of my friends. Let me have this.
You're already my friend, David. You don't have to sound cool by boasting about super Earths.
Oh, thank you, Charlotte.
I'm so glad we've had this touching moment together. Please tell me about another planet type.
How about the Chthonians?
The Chthonians?
Yes. These planets are really close to their parent star. They are extreme and clingy. And it's theorized that these types of planets used to be gas giants that lost their atmosphere because their atmosphere was literally stripped away by their star because of how close they are. And now they are just a little core, you know, floating around and roasting.
They're cooking.
But before they were a Chthonian, they were hot Jupiters.
Hot Jupiters? Are you implying that the Jupiter we have now is not attractive enough?
Oh, no. Our Jupiter is so hot. Like, trust me, I love Jupiter. But these ones are hot temperature-wise.
Oh, I see.
They generally exist around F and G type stars, and they're similar to Jupiter in mass and composition, but with really, really short orbital periods. And they're also usually tidally locked, which, if you don't know what tidally locking means, that's okay. It's when a planet orbits, it's not just a planet, it could be a planet or a satellite. When something orbits a body at the same rate at which it rotates on its axis, and this causes the same side of that body to face whatever it's orbiting at all times.
It's like how there's only ever one side of the moon that's facing the Earth.
Exactly. And because they're tidally locked, one side of the gas giant is extremely hot. Normally, for a planet that's tidally locked, the side that faces its star will be extremely hot because obviously it's being constantly bombarded with light, and the other side will be extremely cold. But gas giants can be a little bit different because they have some extreme convection currents and, you know, tons of wind going around the planet at all times, so the heat can be a little bit more distributed. But there's still a temperature difference, I'm pretty sure.
I would expect so. I mean, there's plenty of temperature differences on Earth.
But one of the more interesting things about hot Jupiters is that many believe that they formed like farther away from their star and for some reason migrated closer. And when they got closer, they just stayed in that orbit. And this even causes them to just balloon outwards because there's so much heat that the gas just expands and it just balloons outward. And sometimes this even causes the planet to lose its like spherical shape and they'll become more like oblong. So you'll have some eggs. And that's where eggs from. So the chicken really did not come from the egg, come first. The egg came before the chicken.
Oblong Jupiters. What another unrealistic beauty standard.
Exactly, you know? You don't have to be egg-shaped to be beautiful, guys, okay?
Jupiter, you're good enough the way you are. You don't have to be a hot Jupiter. We still think you're awesome.
So let's talk about these rogue planets. These are the baddies. They are planets that were so bad that they just got ejected from their solar system.
They don't need no stinking stars.
All the other planets were like, we don't want this, you're toxic, get out. And that's what they did. They moved out, and they cut contact with all the other planets. And now they're just roaming in the dark, just across the galaxy, and being free. They're finding themselves. You know, they're going to some music festivals with some friends they meet along the way, and, you know, maybe couch surfing, hitchhiking. They're living the life.
They're unattached.
They're
in more ways than one.
They're true Zen. So we know about what types of exoplanets there are, but, like, Charlotte, do you think you can give me some specifics?
Well, how about this one? I'll tell you about 51 Pegasi b. It's formally named Dimidium, but it's also called Bellerophon. It's about 50 light years away in the Pegasus constellation, actually.
Ooh.
So, you know, we've probably all heard of Pegasus, you know, from mythology.
Yeah.
He's been around for a few years, so I hope you've all heard about Pegasus and aren't getting spoiled by this. So, it was the first exoplanet to be discovered that was orbiting a main sequence star, which means it's like the sun. The star it orbits is 51 Pegasi, and it was discovered in 1995, only a few years after 1992, which was when the first exoplanet was discovered. So Pegasi b is actually a hot Jupiter, like we mentioned before. So it has half of the mass of our Jupiter, but it's 1.5 times as large as our Jupiter, just because the gas is expanded. And its year, the orbit period, is 4 Earth days long.
Ooh, that's a very short year.
Yes, it is zooming.
I mean, at least my birthday will be coming by so quickly.
You were going to age so fast. You were so old on 51 Pegasi b.
I don't think time would go any differently.
No, you're old. You're an old man, David.
Wow, I guess relativity just really starts getting crazy at this point.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And we haven't even started talking about black holes.
Oh, yeah, just wait.
So its closeness to its star and its similarity to Jupiter seemed a little bit strange to scientists at the time. They were like, what's this gas planet doing so close to its star? That makes me uncomfortable. They're supposed to farm far away from the stars, like our gas planets. So that led them to sort of think that, hey, maybe it formed out there, but sort of came in over time.
It just, you know, inched its way in. It was like, I'm getting kind of cold. Let's get
moseyed
warmed
on
up.
Down.
And then people were like, don't get there. You'll get too hot. And it's like, what? I can't hear you. My earbuds are in.
51 Pegasi b took one earbud out and said, what? And by then it had already expanded and started.
It was too late. But do you want to hear another joke?
Yes, I would love to hear a joke.
So the year is 2008. You know, things are lovely, you know, I mean, except for certain parts of America where the housing kind of crashed, but that's a different thing. But we're all sitting there, and they say, hey, guess what? We found a goth planet. And we look at the calendar, and we see it's April 1st. It's April Fool's. We're like, no way, you're joking. You're just joshing us. And they said, no, we did. And it's called WASP-12b. Now, it's a hot Jupiter that absorbs 94% of the light that shines on it. So if you were to look at it, it would appear almost pitch black. And it's really in that phase. You know, everyone had that phase where, you know, if you looked at any part of them, it was just like pitch black. You know,
yeah.
They only shopped at like
Hot Topic. Listening to MCR.
My Chemical Romance, baby. And it's so close to its star that it doesn't even have a spherical shape anymore. It's more like an egg. Its year beats Pegasi's.
It does.
You want to guess how long it takes?
I will guess half of a day.
Just a little over one day. To complete one orbit around its star.
Wow, that's like 365 orbits a year.
Its radius is 3 times that of Jupiter's, and it's 40% more massive.
So its gas is also expanding a lot.
Oh, it's not just expanding, Charlotte. It's being shed from the planet, meaning it's eventually just going to be completely consumed by its star.
Oh my God, how long does it have left?
The doctors say it only has 10 million years left.
Oh God.
We need that foghorn right now.
It's such a short time to say goodbye in.
It is.
WASP-12b, we will miss you.
But we will still have Kepler-186f.
So Kepler-186f, it was discovered in 2014, right?
Yes, look at you being all smart. It was the first rocky and Earth-sized planet to be discovered in a habitable zone, and it's like 492 light-years away.
That's kind of far.
Yeah, it's a little far, you know. It's
like more than a day's walk.
It's definitely more than a day's walk. I'd say it's probably like, you know, over an hour of driving to get there.
I hate driving for long
distances. You might need to take a plane. We don't have as much information on it as we do about the other planets because, you know, specifically things like its composition are unknown, which would affect, you know, definitely its mass.
Mm-hmm.
But if its composition is Earth-like, which it very well might be, it would be 1.4 times that of Earth.
Wow, so just a little bigger.
50% bigger.
Yeah.
But it orbits a red dwarf, which is really cool. Now, red dwarfs emit less light than main sequence stars, obviously. You know, that's common knowledge. Everyone knows that.
Everybody knows about main sequence stars.
And specifically, 186F only gets 32% of the light that we do. And you want to know a tidbit?
Tell me a tidbit.
You want to know a tidbit?
Give me a tidbit.
Oh, you want to know a tidbit. So, at high noon, when Kepler is highest in 186F sky,
mm-hmm.
it would only be as bright as the sun is on Earth an hour before sunset.
Wow. It's very dim there.
It would be. Now, because of this, the planet sounds like it'd be a little icy, mm-hmm. but with enough CO2, it's very likely it would have liquid water on its surface.
That's very exciting, David.
Yes, but to put this all in perspective, for a red dwarf, its habitable zone is a lot closer to it than the habitable zone of a main sequence star because it's outputting less light, its temperature is lower, you know, all of that.
It's red, which means it's sort of less bright than the sun.
Yeah. Kepler-186f, its year is only about 130 days for us, which means it's closer to its star than we are to ours, but its temperatures could very well be colder.
So what else is there in terms of exoplanets?
You got to mention Gliese.
Gliese 581c specifically. So it was discovered April 27th in 2007. It seems to be like very promising looking. It's an exoplanet. It's in its habitable zone of its star, but it is tidally locked facing its star, which means that the habitable area on it is limited because one side, of course, will be warmer than the other. It is, in fact, a super Earth and not a hot Jupiter like many of the ones we've talked about, and it is 5.5 times the mass of the Earth.
Ooh, that's a chunky boy.
Yeah, it's a big old boy.
Got that chunk.
So it's about 20 light years away, and its orbital period is actually 13 days. And we, in fact, sent a radio signal to the planet on October of 2008.
Ooh, when will they get the message?
2029, so only 9 years from now, guys.
Ooh, wait a minute. The planet is tidally locked, right?
Yes.
So that means its habitable zone is going to be very limited.
Yeah.
Who's going to get this message? Microbes? Like, that area is going to be way too small for, like... Wait, why did they choose this planet to submit?
They message a lot of planets, David.
Wait, so we're messaging more than one?
Yeah, we're hitting up multiple DMs, my guy.
I thought Gliese was the only one we were talking to.
No, we can't commit at this time. We are just hitting everyone up. We need to find someone. We are lonely.
Gliese really got that message that said, "You're the only one I'm talking to," but that message was also sent to 24,000 others.
This is how we are.
We're the Chads of Earth is a Chad.
The Earth is not a Chad because nobody is talking to Earth.
Exactly. Nobody talks to Chads either.
So why are we hitting up all these planets?
Oh, we're lonely. We just want a friend.
We want to see the aliens.
If any aliens are out there, please come over. I'm bored. I have the Switch. We can play it together. please.
We could play Just Dance too.
When Animal Crossing comes out, we can play it together.
So we are really just trying to look at all these planets to try and find more Earth-like ones, right? So even if we are finding all these wacky ones, we want ones that are like us.
Yeah, and it's also pretty cool to see all these wacky planets out there, you know, to see things that, you know, they were discovering planets that they originally thought shouldn't exist, but lo and behold, here they are. And we're seeing things such as planets that are in the middle of being consumed by their star. Like, that's pretty radical to see.
It is. I think it's really amazing. Observing will really show us how our galaxy and our stars and our solar system has all sort of been formed, instead of just sort of theorizing and trying to understand. Observation really sort of helps us in this way.
Yeah, and it can also show us what a normal solar system typically looks like, which so far we've seen there's so many different types of solar systems. Some of them have gas giants extremely close to their star, others have an insane amount of planets, and some have no planets.
If we only looked at our solar system, we would say, oh, well, the gas planets have to be far away, and the rocky planets have to be close.
But they don't. So what's going on right now in the search?
So we're trying to look at ones that are capable of supporting life, but what makes a planet habitable? It's kind of complicated, and it's kind of hard to figure out, especially if it's really far away, if it is habitable. For example, I think the Kepler-186f, you say, oh, well, it's in the habitable zone because it's close to its red dwarf star. But if you're too close to a red dwarf, you might get a lot of radiation, which may make it uninhabitable, even if it is in the habitable zone.
Exactly.
So it's complicated. Right now, we're looking at planets that are similar to Earth and have the same sort of common elements and compounds that we can try and detect. But there are a few scientists, like C.R. Sager at MIT, that are trying to look into alternative conditions to supporting life. All life that we currently know about, everything on Earth, is carbon-based. Carbon's a cool element, got four bonds, really, really makes connections, really a good networker, gets out there, a people person, a compounds element. It's in everything that's alive on Earth, but we don't know if things that are not on Earth will use carbon. They should, it's a pretty cool element, but there's nothing that would guarantee that. So maybe they're using an element similar to carbon to bond with. Like maybe,
You mean like a great value carbon?
Yeah, great value carbon. Something similar, but, you know, just a little off-brand. Maybe it doesn't work as well. Oh, like silicon.
Ooh, silicon. That sounds spicy.
Oh, yeah, silicon. It's in the same group as carbon, similar in a lot of ways. However, it does not react as quickly as carbon, so that's why it's not favored.
Their organic processes would be so slow.
Just moving slowly.
Our turtles would seem so fast.
Oh my god. Our turtles are so much faster than the space turtles.
Space turtles are not moving. You think they are, but they're just not.
Nope. It's turtles all the way down. Anyways, there are people looking into this kind of thing, even if we don't really know much about it right now. But with the help of future generations and more observation, we'll be able to learn more and more, and maybe we'll learn something about life on Earth, too. Thank you for joining us for this episode of The Rover. If you're interested in more astrobiology, you can take a look at our Twitter and Instagram accounts at Aries Research for more information about astrobio and related topics, as well as a peek at our projects that our other club members are working on. Until next time.